Welcome back, Hemingway listeners, to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway, talking about part two, chapter two. Maybe not the same old Emma after all. She seems optimistic. A little bit of a change in Emma's, I was expecting her to be grumpy and petulant, but she wasn't. And so that was a pleasant surprise. Spent a little bit of time today finishing off the trailer for my book, doing a book trailer, which I've never done a book trailer before. My previous two novels I just released and had a book launch party. Can't have a book launch party this time around because of the old COVID thingy. So it'll be an online launch. And so I thought, do a book trailer. Book trailers are always like super corny. It's like a film trailer for a book, as the name would suggest. And then often they'll have like a bit of an extract from the book read over it. And it just comes out corny. But that's the point. So I've done mine. It's really corny. But I also think it's kind of like nice and moody. Very kind of student film-esque. And I had the most fun I had was doing the music for it. Because I played bass guitar. And so when it came to doing the music, I literally had one trick up my sleeve. You know, this bit of music should have had all kinds of instruments on it. But seeing as I'm not proficient at any instrument other than bass guitar, it's just a bass guitar music thingy, score, I suppose. But it was really fun to do. Dark, ominous tones. And it's a moody old book from a moody old author. And the little book trailer sets that mood. It's a moody thing. So I'm happy with that. It's coming out tomorrow night. Big, big release. I will link it, because I'm going to just put it on YouTube and I'll put it on my Instagram as well. I'll link it, the YouTube thing, on this subreddit. Or you can follow me on Instagram at @AnderLewis, and you'll see it there. And that will mark the launch of pre-sales for the book. I just need a couple of weeks to do these last couple of things getting ready for the launch. So a couple of weeks is all I need, and then they'll be sent out. So there will be pre-orders, but it won't be a super long pre-order period of like months or weeks or anything. It'll just be, I'd say the books will be posted out early to mid-May. Okay, so a couple of weeks, maybe 2 weeks they'll be posted. Exciting though. I'm very excited. I'm only going to release it to start with for the first little while, for the first 6 months or so, as a hardback. Reason being is that on the shelf right behind me, actually, if I turn around, there is a first edition copy of Breakfast at Tiffany's and a book club edition copy of To Kill a Mockingbird. Book club edition is a copy that came out the same year as the first edition, so it's from the year it was released, but it was on, they were printed on slightly cheaper paper and for the purposes of going to book clubs, so they weren't made to last as long, these book club editions. But it's essentially a first edition but on cheaper stock. But they're both hardback books with the dust jacket that wraps around. And the form factor is the sort of smaller hardback size. And so that's the form factor that I've chosen to release my book, because when I look at these collector's items behind me, they're just the most special books on my shelves. I've got them on display on book holders. And to just pick them up and hold them, they just feel special. And when I wrote this book, I suppose, like, I just want it to be as special as it can be as a thing that exists. So when it goes out there in the world, I want you to be able to hold it and go, oh, look at that, like, what a special item. So that's the way I'm going to release it to start with. down the track, I suppose I'll put it as a paperback. You know, it's how every book ends up, as a paperback. And I'll probably do an ebook as well. But to start with, just a special, special one. So if you want the first edition of the book, it will be a hardback. Which, you know, adds another $5 per unit to the price, to the sale price. But it also adds, I think it adds much more than $5 value worth of specialness. They just feel really, I don't know, like I've got a copy here, a test copy. And it's one of the nicer books to hold that I've got on my bookshelf. And I know I'm complimenting myself here, but I just mean in terms of the form factor. I love the size. I love the dust jacket. I love the colors of the cover. I love the colors of the cardboard, of the, you know, of the book, the hard book. I'm just really, really happy with how it came out. And so I want everyone to experience the book in its most special form. Oh my God, I'm rambling. Talk about rambling. It will be going on sale, pre-sale tomorrow, on andalewis.com. I'll chuck a link to that on the trailer. Watch the trailer. See if the mood strikes you, and if it's the kind of mood of a book that you feel like, and hopefully some of you will check it out. I feel like we've known each other long enough that you should maybe see what a writer I am. Some of you have read my older novels, but I just feel like they're so, like my most recent book came out 6 years ago and was written 2 years before that. So I've developed 8 years of trying to be a writer since that, you know? So I just feel like I'm proud of those books, but that doesn't demonstrate the writer that I am today. And this book, to some degree, it does. At least to a larger degree, it does, I should say. All right. Let's have a look at what old Emma's up to. Old Madame Bovary. Homace, says Simply Productive. Boring. I'm glad she's happier, but Jesus, this was almost as bad as the date I went on with a super conservative guy who claimed that women's rights can be linked to the degradation of society and women should renounce their right to vote. Except that guy was interesting because he pissed me off, and Homace is just boring. What a viewpoint to have. And also, if you have that viewpoint, why would you bring it up on a first date with a woman? Wow. On the positive side, I would love to hear his rationale behind that, by the way. On the positive side, says Simply Productive, she may well be able to find some happiness here because she found a friend who speaks like he's describing things to their fullest. If she loves prose and the romantic and things that seem romantic, like architecture and poetry, she'll love this guy. Wouldn't it be disappointing if they ended up having an affair? Oh, God. It really would. Just from a plot point of view, I'm so sick of the love triangle thing. Every book seems to have a love triangle. There was a sentence. I'm not going to go back and find it, but when that guy was talking, Homace, it was so chock full of obscure words. It was like comical, even like to the extent to which he flowered his language. Flowered? I don't know what I mean by that. Made it flowery, you know, overly grandiose. Charolette said, a couple of chapters ago, some people were saying Emma was so sick of Tostes that any change would be for the better. It seems like that was bang on. I can't believe Homace gave the max temperature for the area in three different temperature systems. What a boring chatterbox. Oh yeah, he did. He did do that. Because that was during the dialogue. I just thought that was the narrator, but no, that was him that did that. excuse me. Emma and Leon are certainly seeing eye to eye with their romantic ideas. I can't imagine he will be a good influence on her. Swim said the mama. Fishy says, uh-oh, Leon is potential trouble. Oh, yeah. Al Treat said, Emma and Leon certainly seem like kindred spirits. Here's how Leon's first words are introduced. It's such a dismal thing, sighed the clerk, always to be stuck in the same place. Sounds like something straight out of Emma's heart. Mezzo Piano 1234 said, Leon seems to share many interests with Emma. Their conversation sounds dry and trite, but they seem connected and sentimental. Hopefully her life will be better here. Leon. I'm gonna steal this young lady away from her poor old sap of a husband, Charles. Isolation Diary. I don't actually know how many days I'm up to. I'm going to say it's been more than a month. Oh, I don't know what to tell you. I'm so bored. This project of launching my book, which is usually, by the way, a book launch. My first two book launches have been just about the most nerve-wracking times of my life, the lead up to a book launch. Especially my first one, I was riddled with anxiety about that. My second one too, to a lesser degree, but still very anxious about the release. And then this new one, my third novel, it's barely a blip on my radar just because of this whole situation of being isolated. So it's a really interesting time to release a book. Yeah. I do hope some of you will get it and read it, because I'm very curious to know what you guys reckon, I suppose. And I think you will enjoy it, and I like to think that I could give you something that you'll enjoy. That's a nice feeling. Anyway, okay. That's my isolation update. And also, I've been eating way too much junk food, and I'm going to die if I don't get that in order. So I'm aware of that. My poor heart. I'm breathing heavily as I'm talking. What the hell? Too much junk food. All right, chapter 3, let's go. The next day, as she was getting up, she saw the clerk on the place. She had on a dressing gown. He looked up and bowed. She nodded quickly and reclosed the window. Leon waited all day for 6 o'clock in the evening to come, but on going to the inn, he found no one but Monsieur Binet already at a table. The dinner of the evening before had been a considerable event for him. He had never till then talked for 2 hours consecutively to a lady. How then had he been able to explain, and in such language, the number of things that he could not have said so well before? He was usually shy and maintained that reserve which partakes at once of modesty and dissimulation. At Yonville he was considered well-bred. He listened to arguments of the older people and did not seem hot about politics, a remarkable thing for a young man. Then he had some accomplishments. He painted in watercolours, could read the key of G, and readily talked literature after dinner when he did not play cards. Monsieur Hermès respected him for his education. Madame Hermès liked him for his good nature, for he often took the little Hermès into the garden, little brats who were always dirty, very much spoilt, and somewhat lymphatic, like their mother. Besides the servant to look after them, they had Justin, the chemist's apprentice, a second cousin of Monsieur Hermès, who had been taken into the house from charity and who was useful at the same time as a servant. The druggist proved the best of neighbours. He gave Madame Bovary information as to the tradespeople, sent expressly for his own cider merchant, tasted the drink himself, and saw that the casks were properly placed in the cellar. He explained how to set about getting in a supply of butter cheap and made an arrangement with Lestiboudois, the sacristan, who besides his sac sacerdotal and funeral functions, looked after the principal gardens at Yonville by the hour or the year, according to the taste of the customers. The need of looking after others was not the only thing that urged the chemist to such obsequious cordiality. There was a plan underneath it all. He had infringed the law of the 19th Ventose, Year 11, Article 1, which forbade all persons not having a diploma to practice medicine, so that, after certain anonymous denunciations, Holmes had been summoned to Rouen to see the procurer of the king in his own private room, the magistrate receiving him standing up, ermine on shoulder and cap on head. It was in the morning before the court opened. In the corridors, one heard the heavy boots of the gendarmes walking past, and like a far-off noise, great locks that were shut. The druggist's ears tingled as if he were about to have an apoplectic stroke. He saw the depths of dungeons, his family in tears, his shop sold, all the jars dispersed, and he was obliged to enter a cafe and take a glass of rum and seltzer to recover his spirits. Little by little, the memory of his reprimand grew fainter, and he continued, as heretofore, to give anodyne consultations in his back parlour. But the mayor resented it. His colleagues were jealous. Everything was to be feared. Gaining over Monsieur Bovary by his attentions was to earn his gratitude and prevent his speaking out later on, should he notice anything. So every morning Hermes brought him the paper, and often in the afternoon left his shop for a few moments to have a chat with the doctor. Charles was dull. Patients did not come. He remained seated for hours without speaking, went into his consulting room to sleep, or watched his wife sewing. Then for diversion he employed himself at home as a workman. He even tried to do up the attic with some paint, which had been left behind by the painters. But money matters worried him. He had spent so much for repairs at Tostes for Madame's toilet and for the moving that the whole dowry, over 3,000 crowns, had slipped away in 2 years. Then how many things had been spoilt or lost during their carriage from Tostes to Yonville, without counting the plaster cure, who, falling out of the coach at an over-severe jolt, had been dashed into 1,000 fragments on the pavement of Quincampoix. A pleasanter trouble came to distract him, namely the pregnancy of his wife. As the time of her confinement approached, he cherished her the more. It was another bond of the flesh establishing itself, and, as it were, a continued sentiment of a more complex union. When from afar he saw her languid walk and her figure without stays, turning softly on her hips, when opposite one another he looked at her at his ease, while she took tired poses in her armchair. Then his happiness knew no bounds. He got up, embraced her, passed his hands over her face, called her a little mama, wanted to make her dance, and half laughing, half crying, uttered all kinds of caressing pleasantries that came into his head. The idea of having begotten a child delighted him. Now he wanted nothing. He knew human life from end to end, and he sat down to it with serenity. Emma, at first, felt a great astonishment, then was anxious to be delivered, that she might know what it was to be a mother. But not being able to spend as much as she would have liked, to have a swing bassinet with rose silk curtains and embroidered caps, in a fit of bitterness she gave up looking after the trousseau, and ordered the whole of it from a village needlewoman, without choosing or discussing anything. Thus she did not amuse herself with those preparations that stimulate the tenderness of mothers, and so her affection was from the very outset, perhaps, to some extent, attenuated. As Charles, however, spoke of the boy at every meal, she soon began to think of him more consecutively. She hoped for a son. He would be strong and dark. She would call him George, and this idea of having a male child was like an expected revenge for all her impotence in the past. A man at least is free. He may travel over passions and over countries, over obstacles, taste of the most faraway pleasures. But a woman is always hampered, at once inert and flexible. She has against her the weakness of the flesh and legal dependence. Her will, like the veil of her bonnet held by a string, flutters in every wind. There is always some desire that draws her, some conventionality that restrains. That was my phone going ba-ding. She was confined on a Sunday at about 6 o'clock as the sun was rising. It's a girl, said Charles. She turned her head away and fainted. Madame Hermès, as well as Madame Lefrançois of the Lion d'Or, almost immediately came running in to embrace her. The chemist, as man of discretion, only offered a few provincial felicitations through the half-open door. He wished to see the child and thought it well made. Whilst she was getting well, she occupied herself much in seeking a name for her daughter. First, she went over all those that have Italian endings, such as Clara, Louisa, Amanda, Itala. She liked Galsuindi pretty well, and Yasult and or Leosadi still better. Charles wanted the child to be called after her mother. Emma opposed this. They ran over the calendar from end to end and then consulted outsiders. Monsieur Leon, said the chemist, with whom I was talking about it the other day, wonders you do not choose Madeline. It is very much in fashion just now. But Madame Bovary Senior cried out loudly against the name of a sinner. As to Monsieur Hermès, he had a preference for all those that recalled some great man, an illustrious fact, or generous idea, and it was on this system that he had baptized his four children. Thus Napoleon represented glory, and Franklin, liberty. Irma was perhaps a concession to romanticism, but Athalie was a homage to the greatest masterpiece of the French stage. For his philosophical convictions did not interfere with his artistic tastes. In him, the thinker did not stifle the man of sentiment. He could make distinctions, make allowances for imagination and fanaticism. In this tragedy, for example, he found fault with the ideas, but admired the style. He detested the conception, but applauded all the details, and loathed the characters while he grew enthusiastic over their dialogue. When he read the fine passages, he was transported, but when he thought the murmurs would get something out of them for their show, he was disconsolate. And in this confusion of sentiments in which he was involved, he would have liked at once to crown Racine with both his hands and discuss with him for a quarter of an hour. At last, Emma remembered that at the Chateau of Vaubyessard, she had heard the Marchioness call a young lady Berthe. From that moment, this name was chosen, and as old Rouault could not come, Monsieur Hermès was requested to stand godfather. His gifts were all products from his establishment, to wit, 6 boxes of jujubes, a whole jar of racahout, 3 cakes of marshmallow paste, and 6 sticks of sugar candy into the bargain that he had come across in a cupboard. On the evening of the ceremony, there was a grand dinner. The cure was present. There was much excitement. Monsieur Hermès, towards liquor time, began singing Le Dieu de Bons Gens. Monsieur Leon sang a bar carole, and Madame Bovary Senior, who was godmother, a romance of the time of the Empire. Finally, Monsieur Bovary Senior insisted on having the child brought down, and began baptizing it with a glass of champagne that he poured over its head. This mockery of the first of the sacraments made the Abbe Bournisien angry. Old Bovary replied by a quotation from La Guerre des Dieux. The cure wanted to leave. The ladies implored Hermès interfered, and thus they succeeded in making the priest sit down again, and he quietly went on with the half-finished coffee in his saucer. Monsieur Bovary Senior stayed at Yonville a month, dazzling the natives by a superb policeman's cap with silver tassels that he wore in the morning when he smoked his pipe in the square. Being also in the habit of drinking a good deal of brandy, he often sent the servant to the Lion d'Or to buy him a bottle, which was put down to his son's account, and to perfume his handkerchiefs he used up his daughter-in-law's whole supply of eau de cologne. The latter did not at all dislike his company. He had knocked about the world. He talked about Berlin, Vienna, and Strasbourg, of his soldier times, of the mistresses he had had, the grand luncheons of which he had partaken. Then he was amiable, and sometimes even, either on the stairs or in the garden, would seize hold of her waist, crying, "Charles, look out for yourself." Then Madame Bovary senior became alarmed for her son's happiness, and fearing that her husband might in the long run have an immoral influence upon the ideas of the young woman, took care to hurry their departure. Perhaps she had more serious reasons for uneasiness. Monsieur Bovary was not the man to respect anything. One day Emma was suddenly seized with the desire to see her little girl, who had been put to nurse with the carpenter's wife, and without looking at the calendar to see whether the 6 weeks of the Virgin were yet past, she set out for the Rollet's house, situated at the extreme end of the village between the high road and the fields. It was midday, the shutters of the houses were closed, and the slate roofs that glittered beneath the fierce light of the blue sky seemed to strike sparks from the crest of the gables. A heavy wind was blowing. Emma felt weak as she walked. The stones of the pavement hurt her. She was doubtful whether she would not go home again or go in somewhere to rest. At this moment, Monsieur Léon came out from the neighbouring door with a bundle of papers under his arm. He came to greet her and stood in the shade in front of the Leroux's shop under the projecting grey awning. Madame Bovary said she was going to see her baby, but that she was beginning to grow tired. "If," said Léon, but not daring to go on. "Have you any business to attend to?" she asked. And on the clerk's answer she begged him to accompany her that same evening. This was known in Yonville, and Madame Tuvache, the mayor's wife, declared in the presence of her servant that Madame Bovary was compromising herself. To get to the nurse's it was necessary to turn left on the leaving the street as if making for the cemetery, and to follow between little houses and yards a small path bordered with privet hedges. They were in bloom, and so were the speedwells, eglantines, thistles, and the sweet briar that sprang up from the thickets. Through openings in the hedges one could see into the huts, some pigs on a dung heap or tethered cows rubbing their horns against the trunks of trees. The two, side by side, walked slowly, she leaning upon him, and he restraining his pace, which he regulated by hers. In front of them a swarm of midges fluttered, buzzing in the warm air. They recognized the house by an old walnut tree which shaded it. Low and covered with brown tiles, there hung outside it, beneath the dormer window of the garret, a string of onions, faggots upright against a... Faggots upright against a thorn fence, surrounded a bed of lettuce, a few square feet of lavender, and sweet peas strung on sticks. That's the old usage of the word faggots, by the way. Bundle of sticks, I believe. Dirty water was running here and there on the grass, and all round were several indefinite rags, knitted stockings, a red calico jacket, and a large sheet of coarse linen spread over the hedge. At the noise of the gate, the nurse appeared with a baby she was suckling on one arm. With her other hand she was pulling along a poor, puny little fellow, his face covered with scrofula, the son of Rouen Hosier, whom his parents, too, taken up with their business, left in the country. "Go in," she said, "your little one is there asleep." The room on the ground floor, the only one in the dwelling, had it at its farther end against the wall, a large bed without curtains, while a kneading through took up the side by the window, one pane of which was mended with a piece of blue paper. In the corner behind the door, shining hobnailed shoes stood in a row under the slab of the washstand, near a bottle of oil with a feather stuck in its mouth. A Matthew Leisenberg lay on the dusty mantelpiece amid gunflints, candle ends, and bits of amadou. Finally, the last luxury in the apartment was a Fame blowing her trumpets, a picture cut out, no doubt, from some perfumer's prospectus and nailed to the wall with six wooden shoe pegs. Emma's child was asleep in a wicker cradle. She took it up in the wrapping that enveloped it and began singing softly as she rocked herself to and fro. Léon walked up and down the room. It seemed strange to him to see this beautiful woman in her nankeen dress in the midst of all this poverty. Madame Bovary reddened. He turned away, thinking perhaps there had been an impertinent look in his eyes. Then she put back the little girl who had just been sick over her collar. The nurse at once came to dry her, protesting that it would not show. "She gives me other doses," she said. "I am always a washing of her. if you would have the goodness to order Camus, the grocer, to let me have a little soap, it would really be more convenient for you, as I needn't trouble you then. Very well, said Emma. Good morning, Madame Roulette. And she went out wiping her shoes at the door. The good woman accompanied her to the end of the garden, talking all the time of the trouble she had getting up of nights. I am that worn out sometimes as I drop asleep on my chair. I am sure you might at least give me just a pound of ground coffee. That'd last me a month, and I'd take it of a morning with some milk. After having submitted to her thanks, Madame Bovary left. She had gone a little way down the path when, at the sound of wooden shoes, she turned around. It was the nurse. What is it? Then the peasant woman, taking her aside behind an elm tree, began to talk of her, to her, of her husband, who, with his trade and 6 francs a year, that the captain. Oh, be quick, said Emma. Well, the nurse went on, heaving sighs between each word, I'm afraid he'll be put out seeing me have a coffee alone, you know, men. But you are to have some, Emma repeated. I will give you some. You bother me. Oh, dear, my poor dear lady. You see, in consequence of his wounds, he has terrible cramps in his chest. He even says that cider weakens him. Do make haste, Mia Rollet. Well, the latter continued, making a curtsy. If it weren't asking too much, and she curtsied once more, if you would, and her eyes begged, a jar of brandy, she said at last, and I'd rub your little one's feet with it. They're as tender as one's tongue. Once rid of the nurse, Emma again took Monsieur Leon's arm. She walked fast for some time, then more slowly, and looking straight in front of her, her eyes rested on the shoulder of a young man whose frock coat had a black velvety collar. His brown hair fell over it, straight and carefully arranged. She noticed his nails were longer than one wore them at Yonville. She noticed his nails, which were longer than one wore them at Yonville. I was trying to think then, like, is it just me or is this a boring chapter? But no, no. She's describing the length of people's nails. It was one of the clerk's chief occupations to trim them. Oh, in more detail. Cool. Yeah, let's keep going here. It was one of the clerk's chief occupations to trim them, and for this purpose he kept a special knife in his writing desk. Oh, this is a very entertaining book. They returned to Yonville by the waterside. In the warm season, the bank, wider than at other times, showed to their foot. The garden walls, whence a few steps led to the river, it flowed noiselessly, swift and cold to the eye. Long, thin grasses, huddled together in its current, drove above them, spread themselves upon the limpid water like streaming hair, sometimes at the tip of the reeds, blah, 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 continuing to describe a river. Sometimes at the tip of the reeds or on the leaf of a water lily, an insect with fine legs crawled or rested. The sun pierced with a ray the small blue bubbles of the waves that breaking followed each other. Branchless old willows mirrored their grey backs, and the water beyond all around the meadows seemed empty. It was the dinner hour at the farms, and the young woman and her companion heard nothing as they walked but the fall of their steps on the earth of the path, the words they spoke, and the sound of Emma's dress rustling around her. The walls of the garden with pieces of bottle and their coping were hot as the glass windows of the conservatory. Wallflowers had sprung up between the bricks, and with the tip of her open sunshade, Madame Bovary, as she passed, made some of their faded flowers crumble into a yellow dust, or a spray of overhanging honeysuckle and clematis caught in its fringe and dangled for a moment over the silk. They were talking of a troupe of Spanish dancers who were expected shortly at the Ruined Theatre. Are you going, she asked. If I can, he answered. Had they nothing else to say to one another, yet their eyes were full of more serious speech, and while they forced themselves to find trivial phrases, they felt the same languor stealing over them both. It was the whisper of the soul, deep, continuous, dominating that of their voices. Surprised with wonder at this strange sweetness, they did not think of speaking of the sensation of seeking its cause. Coming joys like tropical shores throw over the immense city before them the inborn softness of odorous wind, and we are lulled by this intoxication without a thought of the horizon that we do not even know. In one place the ground had been trodden down by the cattle. They had stepped on large green stones put here and there in the mud. She often stopped a moment to look where to place her foot, and tottering on a stone that shook, her arms outspread, her form bent forward with a look of indecision, she would laugh, afraid of falling into the puddles of water. When they arrived in front of her garden, Madame Bovary opened the little gate, ran up the stairs, and disappeared. Leon returned to his office. His chief was away. He glanced at his briefs, then cut himself with a pen, and at last he took up in his hat and went out. He went to the La Pâture at the top of the Aguil Hills at the beginning of the forest. Then he threw himself upon the ground, upon the pines, and watched the sky through his fingers. How bored I am, he said to himself. How bored I am. He thought he was to be pitied for living in this village with Homais for a friend and Monsieur Guillaume for a master, the latter entirely absorbed by his business, wearing old gold-rimmed spectacles and red whiskers over a white cravat, understood nothing of mental refinements, although he affected a stiff English manner, which in the beginning had impressed the clerk. As to the chemist's spouse, she was the best wife in Normandy, gentle as a sleep, loving her children, her father, her mother, her cousins, weeping for others' woes, letting everything go in her household and detesting corsets, but so slow of movement, such a bore to listen to, so common in appearance, and such a restricted conversation that although she was 30 and he only 20, although they slept in rooms next to each other and he spoke to her daily, he never thought that she might be a woman for another, or that she possessed anything else of her sex than the gown. And what else was there? Binet, a few shopkeepers, two or three publicans, the cure, and finally Monsieur Tuvache, the mayor, with his two sons, rich, crabbed, obtuse persons, who farmed their own lands and had feasts among themselves, bigoted to boot, and quite unbearable companions. But from the general background of all these human faces, Emma stood out isolated and yet farthest off, for between her and him he seemed to see a vague abyss. In the beginning he had called on her several times with the druggist. Charles had not appeared particularly anxious to see him again, and Leon did not know what to do between his fear of being indiscreet and the desire for an intimacy that seemed almost impossible. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. Oh, my God. That was the worst chapter that we've read for several months of any book. Holy crap. Just stop describing grass and fingernails and bedding and walls and rivers and stop describing the boringness of a conversation. Stop having a conversation that's boring and then taking time to describe how boring it was. Stop doing that in your book. In your book, which is primarily to entertain people. Oh, my God. All right. Have your say about that chapter over on the subreddit. Thank you very much for listening. I'll see you when I see you, which will be tomorrow. Cool.